Warning. This episode includes topics of murder, extreme violence, and sexual assault that some people might be uncomfortable with. Listener discretion is advised, especially for young children.
On December 6th, 1959, at around 4:30 a.m., Dr. Harold Perelson killed his wife using a ball-peen hammer and then bludgeoned his 18-year-old daughter, Judy. Some of the most famous horror movies in cinematic history are actually based on true stories. I, Yeshu Upasani,
and me, Arvind Raghunathan, will shed light on the true stories that inspired these terrifying movies. And we'll be investigating the question on why humans are so interested in the paranormal, and whether their imaginations are able to conjure what's not even there.
There's a lot to find this season. After all, there's always more to uncover behind the story. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Behind the Story, and let us be the first to wish all of you disgusting couples a very happy Valentine's Day. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Yeshu Upasani, the paranormal, dare I say, ghost enthusiast, who is going to prove to you why the supernatural is real.
And I'm Arvind Raghunathan, the skeptic of this podcast, who is going to give you the actually true science-backed-up evidence of why the supernatural is not real.
If this is the first episode of ours that you are listening to, welcome. This is the podcast where we talk about the true stories that inspired famous horror movies. However, we've had a bit of a career shift, and instead of talking about movies, we've spent our past couple of episodes debunking the stories behind the hit show American Horror Story.
If you haven't listened to our other American Horror Story episodes, you should definitely go and check those out. We've covered their Freak Show, Roanoke, and Hotel seasons, and today we're going to tackle the season that started it all, Murder House.
Now, these AHS episodes are a part of our second season, and in this season, we tried to answer two questions. One, why are humans so interested in the paranormal? And two, is it this interest that can cause them to make up the paranormal when it's not even there? But for these AHS episodes, we've looked at different questions, and for this episode, we're wondering whether haunted houses are even real.
And more specifically, if they are, which they're definitely not, what marks a haunted house? Or rather, what makes us believe that a house is haunted in the first place? Do you get why this is the Murder House episode now? And speaking of Murder House, it was the very first season of AHS, and it aired on October 5th, 2011. It starred Evan Peters, Jessica Lange, and Sarah Paulson, and more.
And for this episode, we are going to examine some of the most famous houses that inspired this season. And for those of you who have been listening to this podcast since we aired, get excited, because we're going to revisit the fan favorite Conjuring House.
Don't forget to follow us at Behind the Story on Instagram and Twitter, with a period between the I and N for Instagram and an underscore between the I and N for Twitter, and leave us a message on our anchor.fm website with anything you would like us to know.
We hope you enjoy this episode, and hey, this is the Valentine's Day special. Might as well listen to it with your significant other, because nothing says I love you like listening to gruesome details of a violent crime.
And now, let's get on with the episode.
Now, we've covered a lot of haunted houses on this podcast. From farmhouses in America to houses in England and even a hotel, I think it's pretty safe to say that both Arvind and I have quite a lot of knowledge about haunted houses. But what is it that makes a house haunted? Over the course of our episodes, we've covered how a person can become haunted, symptoms of demonic possession, and more, but what about houses? The first ideas of haunted houses were chronicled in the first AD, where people thought that there were homes that were haunted by fairies. Now, we associate haunted houses with ghosts, demons, and poltergeists, but the idea of where these paranormal entities came from depends on what you believe in. We have said it before in our episodes, but we refer to these entities as ghosts and demons because they are the term that both Arvind and I are most familiar with, even though they are words that are rooted in Christianity. The point is, supernatural entities can be called anything, and they can be created for many different reasons. For example, in Japan, there's a tradition of creating an obakeyashiki, or ghost houses, where the ancestral spirits live. But we're talking about the scary kind of haunted house today. There is no actual explanation for why a house is haunted, but I have a couple of theories. Negative spirits, like demons, are attracted to negative and vulnerable energy, which explains why houses where families are struggling or houses that have had a tragic past with murders and violence are haunted, as opposed to houses that were built in times like 2010. The more negative energy that passes through a house, the more likely it is to attract a demonic entity. Common signs of a haunted house are cold spots, knocking sounds, horrible smells, and the movement of objects with no explainable reason. So essentially, I believe that a house becomes haunted when the house has experienced a history of tragedy and violence. But of course, we always have to hear Arvind's side, even if he's wrong. Take it away, Arvind.
But of course, I never am. many things can make a house haunted, especially relating to the human mind. An article from Smithsonian Magazine by Andrea Michelson outlines some specific explanations. First, the fear frequency. Just below the range of human hearing, infrasound can cause some strange sensations. Humans can't hear sound below 20 hertz, but some people subconsciously respond to lower frequencies with feelings of fear or dread, reports Jennifer Ouellette from Gizmodo. In one account from 1998, engineer Vic Tandy of Coventry University spent a night in a lab believed to be haunted. He and his colleagues experienced anxiety and distress, felt cold shivers down their spines, and Tandy even reported seeing a dark blob out of the corner of his eye. It turned out that there was a silent fan creating sound waves at around 19 hertz, the exact frequency that can cause the human eyeball to vibrate and quote-unquote see optical illusions. When we finally switched it off, it was as if a huge weight was lifted, Tandy told Chris Arnott for The Guardian. The second thing is unusual electromagnetic fields. Electromagnetic fields, or EMF meters, are commonly used to identify electrical problems. They're also a staple of the Ghost Hunter toolbox. Neuroscientist Michael Perringer thinks normal variation in electromagnetic fields cause a possible explanation for the supposed hauntings. He tested his theory in the 1980s by having people wear helmets that discovered weak electromagnetic stimulation. 80% of his test subjects said they felt an unexplained presence in the room while they wore the helmets. What's more, famous spooky spots like Hampton Court Palace have been found to have unusual electromagnetic fields, reports Neil Dangle for The Conversation. And by the way, if I mispronounce any names, that's my fault. There's quite a lot of them in here. Carbon monoxide poisoning. On a Halloween episode of This American Life, host Ira Glass and toxicologist Albert Donne unearthed an old ghost story published by the American Journal of Ophthalmology in 1921. As recounted by Mrs. H., her family moved into an old house and began experiencing what seemed like paranormal activity, the sound of footsteps, strange voices, and even feeling like they were being held down in their beds by an unseen person. Meanwhile, the house plants were dying, and Mrs. H.'s children felt weak and suffered from headaches. A quick investigation revealed that a faulty furnace was filling the house with carbon monoxide fumes. Carbon monoxide poisoning can cause hallucinations and sickness, explaining all of their symptoms. After the furnace was repaired, the hauntings stopped. Next one on the list is sleep paralysis. The most common explanation for a ghost sighting is sleep paralysis. Sleep specialist Priyanka Yadav tells NBC News Diana Mapes. The body is naturally paralyzed during REM sleep, but the feeling of paralysis can cause terror if experienced while awake. Sometimes, the body and the brain get their wires crossed, and a person can experience a few seconds to a couple minutes of waking paralysis, which is often accompanied by hallucinations. Yadav says the hallucinations can involve anything from spiders to ghosts and are usually characterized by a feeling of dread. When someone reports a haunting that happened right around bedtime or after waking in the middle of the night, and that they were so scared they couldn't move, it's enough for Yadav to diagnose a case of sleep paralysis. Next on the list, we have the power of suggestion. Social psychology might have an explanation for reported hauntings that the natural sciences can't resolve. Refinery29 reports that one study found the power of suggestion to be strong enough to make people believe they witnessed a supernatural event. Participants watched a video of purported psychic purposely bending a key with his mind. People who were exposed to positive social influence, meaning that an actor in the group said they saw the key bend, were more likely to report that they also saw the key bend. Participants who were in a room with naysayers and skeptics were more likely to doubt the validity of the trick, but just one person's confident assertion that they believe the psychokinesis was enough to make others believe it as well. Another article on livesciences.com gives more details on experiments about these theories. So coming back to electrifying chills. Another natural explanation for ghosts might be electromagnetic energy. Spirits may not surround us, but electromagnetic fields generated by power lines and electronic devices certainly do. Could electronics be giving off ghostly vibes? A few small experiments suggest electromagnetic fields might have this effect. In 2000, cognitive neuroscientist Michael Persinger of Laurentian University in Canada and his colleague used magnetic fields to stimulate the brain of a 45-year-old man who'd reported previous ghostly experiences. They managed with the magnetic fields to conjure an apparition similar to what the man had seen before, along with a corresponding rush of fear. The next year, in the same journal, Persinger and his colleagues reported on the strange case of a teenage girl who said she'd been impregnated by the Holy Spirit and felt the invisible presence of a baby on her left shoulder. The girl had experienced a brain injury earlier in her life, the researchers wrote, but the trauma wasn't the sole reason for the religious visitation. Next to the girl's bed was an electric clock that generated magnetic pulses similar to those used to trigger seizures in epileptic rats. Once the clock was removed, the feelings of a presence vanished. Persinger and his colleagues argue that some people are particularly prone to the disruption of temporal lobes, which happen where the brain synthesizes information. And if you guys think back to Emily and Annalise, she also had a lot of problems with her temporal lobe and saw things like this. Patients undergoing brain surgery reveals how important the temporal lobe can be to the experience of reality, said Christopher French, a psychologist at Goldsmiths College of University in London, who researches the roots of paranormal experiences. When surgeons stimulate the part of the brain where the temporal and parietal lobe meet, the temporoparietal junction, they can actually switch out the out-of-body experiences on and off. The next one is in your head. But French and his colleagues have found little evidence that infrared and electromagnetic fields explain ghostly apparitions. He and his team tried to create scientific hauntings by building a chamber in which participants were exposed to 50 minutes of infrasound, complex electromagnetic fields, both or neither. The participants then reported the sensations they'd experienced during their time in the chamber. A majority of people have reported some weirdness during the experiment. Almost 80% said they felt dizzy, half said they felt like they were spinning, and 23% felt detached from their bodies, the researchers report in a 2009 in the journal Cortex. Notably, 23% also said they felt a present, and 8% felt sheer terror. Some of these experiences certainly mimic the feeling of a haunting, others not as much. 5% of the participants reported becoming sexually aroused, for example. But when the researchers analyzed the data, they realized it didn't matter which experimental condition the participants were in. It made no difference if the electromagnetic fields were on or off, or if the infrasound was booming, French told Life Sciences. However, they did find that the participants' levels of suggestibility influenced the results. The most parasynonymous explanations, just if you say to suggestible people, go in here and you may have some weird experiences, then some of them do. As French work suggests, the real cause of hauntings may simply be the human brain. In one study published in 1996 in the journal Perceptual and Motor Skills, two participants asked to keep a diary about poltergeist-like activities in their home for a month suddenly started seeing evidence of potential poltergeists all over the place. In a follow-up paper in the same journal, the study researchers hypothesized that haunting events happen because people misperceive slightly ambiguous events as paranormal, and then become primed to look for even more weird stuff. Basic personality traits could also make people particularly likely to attribute a bump in the night to a ghost or a ghoul. A survey recently released by Chapman University in California found that the more generally feared a person, the more he or she is likely to believe in the paranormal. Another study, published online in the Journal of Conscious and Cognition in August of 2013, found that the paranormal believers are more likely to believe in the illusion of agency, but that there was a deliberate entity behind an event. It sounds like someone we know. The study that, based on a theory that people have evolved to see a pattern where none exists. Imagine waking in the woods at night, and said study researcher Michael Van Elk, a psychologist at the University of Amsterdam. You hear a rustle in the trees. Do you keep going or run away? If you keep going, you might be attacked. If you run away, no harm is done. It's better to be safe than sorry, Van Elk told Life Sciences. Evolutionary theorists suggest that this tendency to attribute events to an entity with agency might explain beliefs in ghosts, angels, and demons. To test the idea, Van Elk went to a psychic street fair and asked psychic believers to watch computer animations of moving points of light. Some of the points were arranged to look like joints or invisible stick figures walking. Other dots moved at random. The participants were asked to determine whether the dots were moving randomly or whether a deliberate agent, like a walking person, was behind the motion. In some cases, additional dancing dots were added in to obscure the random or deliberate dots, making the task trickier. Both paranormal believers and non-believers were good at telling the difference from movement with agency and random movement when the distinction was clear. But in more ambiguous cases, the people with greater paranormal beliefs were more likely to jump to an explanation involving someone else than the non-believers were. Even when there were only randomly moving dots, the psychic believers said they saw a human figure moving in the dots, Van Elk said. The study suggested that falling prey in the illusion of agency could explain belief in the paranormal. A draft in an old house or a creak in wood settling could be easily misconstrued as a ghost. It's not clear, however, whether this illusionary agency bias is genetic or learned, Van Elk said. This is still one of the key challenges in the field, to see if it's possible to come up with a good study that tease these two explanations apart. What is the nature part of the story, and what is the nurture part of the story, he said. To the next part, your lying eyes. Indeed, it's tough to know how much to trust other people's own reports of their experiment. In his follow-up, Van Elk wasn't able to replicate his 2013 study. He suspects the reason might be that his original psychic believer participants might be more eager to please than other groups of people. In other words, they might not be hallucinating a person moving on dots on a perceptual level. Instead, they could be interpreting information overly generously in order to meet what they think are the experimenter's expectations. It's not that they're lying, Van Elk said. Rather, their interpretation feels as real to them as an actual perception. It's just that the mistakes arise on a different level of brain processing. The psychic problem isn't the only evidence that suggests people overestimate their own trustworthiness. In one study, French and his team had participants watch a video of psychic supposedly bending a metal key with his mind. As we discussed before, in some version of this experiment, it was concluded by putting the key down on the table and saying, if you look closely, you can see it's still bending. The key was not still bending, but 40% of people who heard the verbal suggestion reported seeing it still bending. By contrast, no one in the group that didn't hear the suggestion said that it had moved at all, French said. And multiple witnesses don't necessarily make a report more believable. When another person in the room said they'd seen the key move after hearing the psychic suggest that it was still bending, the percentage of people who said they saw movement jumped from 40% to 60%. And if you've got one very confident but actually inaccurate witness, it can influence the memory of another witness. Studies find that people with paranormal beliefs tend to have particularly rich imaginations and are inclined to become easily engrossed in tasks, French said. They're also more prone to average and false memories. For example, people prone to false memories might say they remember clearly where they were and who they were with and when they saw a video of the Bali nightclub bombing of 2002. But that bombing was not captured on video. Presumably, what they're doing is they're remembering the time they imagined it, French said. And when they're imagining something, it's so much like the real thing, maybe even more so than it would be to the likes of me, that they're likely to make a false memory.
So, a couple of things I'd like to say. first of all, just as a quick, let's make sure, you know, we want to cover ourselves here. We don't mean to offend anybody when we talk about any of this stuff. You know, when, like, if Arvin's going to come out here and be like, demons are not real, you guys are idiots, you know, we don't mean that. It's more of like, he attacks me, I attack him. You guys continue to believe whatever you want to believe as long as it, you know, doesn't hurt anybody, it makes you feel good, do whatever you want.
Oh, yeah, that's, for sure. Like, I mean, if you look through the stuff that I've said, there's a lot of room for error. So any of you guys could be writing your things. This is just some stuff that I found online. And personally, I like to argue with Yeshvi quite a lot.
Right, but right.
This all is of all you could be right.
Yeah, it's between us. Believe what you want. We, you know, we love everybody. Moving on. Here's what I take as our summary, which is going to make me sound terrible. But I think it's quite funny. So I think houses are haunted because negative energy. Arvin doesn't think houses are haunted because science. Who's right? I'm here to defend myself, defend the demons that might, you know, fester around me because I open myself up to too much negative energy, arguably, all the time. And we have some pretty good haunted house episodes. Okay, what's happening in this episode, as you guys heard in our beginning, is we're talking about haunted houses that we haven't talked about before besides the Conjuring House that inspired this season of American Horror Story. But that doesn't mean that there aren't more haunted houses out there, and we have covered them. Here's what I'm going to say, though. If you want more evidence on the paranormal negative energy-ish side of haunted houses, for my part, I would say listen to our Poltergeist episode from season one, because I think that is some of my greatest theories, and I think it's got some pretty good evidence of the supernatural. Now, for Arvin, I would say, what would you think? Because I'm thinking for you, maybe The Conjuring Part 2 was a good one for you.
The Conjuring Part 2 was a interesting one for me. If you want more evidence of my stuff on Haunted House, The Conjuring Part 1 had some good bullet points, but it wasn't great. I feel like on this is where I give most of the good information. But, I mean, I kind of toss it around every once in a while. There was, like, a sentence of good in the Conjuring 2. Conjuring 2 was not a good argument for me at all.
So he admits.
No, point... I will admit. If you are going on purely an argumentation standpoint, Yeshvi won Conjuring 2. My hallucinogens theory, I don't even know where I got the
plant. Amazing!
Because it was an actual plant, but it's just kind of a stretch that there would be enough there for them to actually hallucinate a poltergeist.
If you guys want to ever make a tally chart where you where you guys mark who you think wins each episode, we would absolutely love to see it.
Yeah, it would, I know, be it'll fantastic. Be 18 to 1, guys, but like,
we would, oh my fine. God, shut up. We would love to see it. We would love to use it, because Arvin and I leave these episodes thinking we have just said the greatest things in the world and that there's no way we're wrong. Yeah. We'd love to see it. So for Arvin's case, I guess listen to all of our episodes and pay attention to his key points.
Yeah, no, I think I talk about some good stuff about all of our episodes, except for maybe Hotel. You probably should watch everything except for AHS Hotel.
I mean, please don't do that. Please listen to all of our episodes. I am not, we spent a lot of this, a lot of our journey in this podcast arguing over science, and when Arvin busts out his little carbon monoxide thing, which is going to be seen a lot in our Veronica and Estefania episode. If you guys want to go check that out, me and Arvin have a very long argument about science in that episode. but before we just move on to these houses, one thing I could quickly argue with Arvin on, because we don't talk about it that much, is, you know, when people make stuff up in their own head, which, you know, fits into our whole theme for season two, which was, can people make up the paranormal? I have a lot of faith in human society, arguably too much sometimes. And I also believe that, like, I, you know, Arvin's sleep paralysis theory, where if you wake up and you see something, like, right after you wake up and you see something, or, like, you know, in the middle of the night hour, sure, that makes perfect sense. But then when we see these hauntings that happen at, like, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, or 6 o'clock in the evening, you know, things that don't happen in a typical, what I call, like, a scary movie time frame, you know, because if you ever watch, like, one of my favorite horror movie franchises of all time is Paranormal Activity. So when you watch those movies, all of the paranormal activity happens at night. Like, that's just the whole thing. And there is a part truth in that, in where, you know, we see more demons act out more around the hours of 3 a.m. as a mock to the Holy Trinity. But that's not our only case, you know, because we've seen things in our Poltergeist episode where things happened in the basement at 3 o'clock, and we see things in even our Conjuring episodes where it's not always happening at night. So I think with human error is a real thing. I'm not saying it isn't, but I'm saying I give people the benefit of the doubt.
Okay. To defend my argument here, I'm going to give a bit of a personal story. Let's say an example from my own life. Yeshri, you know this one in great detail.
Okay.
Let's go back to 6th grade Arvind and Yeshvi.
6th grade Arvind and Yeshvi. Uh-huh.
Yeshvi is telling horror stories on the bus. I think one that she made up herself, that she named The Wanderer. She was telling us this story. And me, who has to go home alone for 4 hours until my parents come home, is terrified out of my tiny mind. So my solution is to go stay with my friend until my mom comes home. So I go stay at his house, I do my homework, whatever, and then I come home, and every, like, 5 minutes, I feel like out of the corner of my eye, there's just, like, a person outside watching me. But it's, like, it's a rabbit, it's a squirrel, it's something. But, like, you feel, like, terror, because you think, your mind is tricking you, hey, you're thinking about this right now? What if it's outside? What if it's inside your house? What if it's right next to you?
True. One quick thing I'd like to add first, though, is, do you guys ever know, like, those, I love sitcoms, I love watching them, and because I like things that revolve around friendship, and so sometimes, though, I always feel bad when I research about the actors after and I realize that they're, like, actually not best friends in real life, like what happens with, like, the Friends crew. And I was like, oh man, you guys will never have to worry about that with Arvind and I, because we have known each other for a very long time. And this is when, in elementary school, I would tell Arvin scary stories on the bus, either stuff that I would make up or things that I would find online. And so this was one of those instances. Here's what I'm saying, though. If Arvin and I were to go ghost hunting, right? Let's say Arvin and I go to the Conjuring house. I am going to expect something paranormal because I believe in it. That is true. But we have our counterpart over here, Mr. Skeptic, who's going to go in and not do anything. I think one of my favorite creators of all time on YouTube is Shane Madej and Ryan Vergara from previously BuzzFeed Unsolved. Now they have their own company, Watcher. And they do ghost hunting. And Shane's a skeptic. Ryan believes in the paranormal. And they still have really good, interesting ghost hunting adventures. Way more... this might be a little shady to say. Way more believable than maybe somebody who has a show on Discovery Channel and, you know, might have a little bit of untruth in their episodes. We're not saying names. but Ryan and Shane have good episodes for that. So I'm just saying, even if you can expect to see the paranormal, I don't think that dismisses the fact that it might still actually be there. Quote of the day. we will argue about this forever, though, and we will continue to argue about this episode. But I think it's good that we need to move on to these haunted houses. So let us talk about the things that have inspired the season that started out everything, Murder House. So now let's move on to the haunted houses that inspired the season that started it all, Murder House. We start with the Perelson House. So the Murder House season is based in Los Angeles, California for a reason. There are a ton of famous murder houses there. The Los Feliz Murder House, or the Perelson House, as I will refer to it as in this episode, is the place for true crime lovers and is one of the city's most notorious homicide sites. Located in the fancy Los Feliz Hills neighborhood, the house looks like a dream, with 5,000 square feet and windows that let so much natural light in, it's insane. So how could anything bad possibly happen in this house? Well, on December 6th, 1959, at around 4:30 a.m., Dr. Harold Perelson killed his wife using a ball-peen hammer and then bludgeoned his 18-year-old daughter, Judy. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's talk about Harold Perelson first. Perelson was 5'7" and hazel-eyed, all information given to us from his World War II draft card, and he had been hospitalized before for his mental health issues. However, it was never fully taken care of. Dr. Perelson was a successful cardiologist and a University of Southern California professor, but despite jobs that should have given him quite a bit of money, his family was in financial trouble. No one knows the real reason for his homicide spree in 1959. Perhaps all of these economic issues were finally getting to him, or this was the consequence of him not treating his mental illness as well. But on December 6th, he killed his wife with one blow to the head with his hammer. When he got to his older daughter's room, who is Judy, he struck her in the head, but that didn't knock her out, and Judy let out a scream. This alerted the younger Perelson kid, Debbie, who was 11 at the time, to run to Judy's room. Judy managed to escape and ran to the home next door, which belonged to Marshall Roth, and Marshall Roth called the police. Marshall went to the Perelson house and found Debbie and their older brother, Joel, who was 13, waiting outside. Marshall found Harold walking around the second floor in a, quote, very agitated state, end quote, and Harold told Marshall to go home. When Marshall left, Harold entered one of the bathrooms and swallowed a high dosage of pills that killed him. Judy had no severe injuries from Harold's strike. The house was sold shortly after to Emily and Julian Enriquez, but they never moved into the house. They simply used the house for storage, but strangely enough, they kept all of the furniture from the Perelsons in the house. In 1994, Rudy Enriquez, their son, inherited the house. He also left the house untouched and uninhabited. Now, I want you guys to fully understand how untouched this house was. All of the room decorations Judy had were still in her room. There were still cans of food in the pantry from when the Perelsons lived there, and Christmas wrapping paper was still left on the floor. Rudy claimed in an interview with the Los Angeles Times in 2009 that he used the house for storage, but he never admitted as to why he kept all of the things from the Perelsons in the house. Rudy had no heirs, so the house was put up to market after he died in 2015. It officially went on sale in March of 2016 at the price of $2.75 million. The house was bought in June of 2016 by Lisa Bloom and her husband, Braden Pollock. Lisa did an extensive remodel of the house and basically was on a mission to renovate the whole thing. However, in May of 2019, she sold the property and is back on the market for $2.5 million when it should have been somewhere around $3 million or more. Lisa claimed that she and her husband had given up after realizing all of the little nitpicky things that would need to be done in order to get the house totally finished. However, she says that, quote, the property would be perfect for someone who wants a 5,000 square foot gutted house to fix up as they'd like, or for a developer ready to tear it down, regrade the hill, and build the house of their dreams, end quote. Now, some people believe that the house is haunted due to just the fact that it's the type of house that should be haunted. After a horrific past and the fact that no one has ever actually lived in the house after the homicide has given true crime and paranormal lovers the chance to speculate that something of another world could possibly be inhabiting the house. There is no proof of this, though.
So now my turn on the Perelson house. First off, as Yeshri said herself, there's not really any evidence of how the house is, like, haunted afterward. Because, like, the next owners haven't had anything bad happen to them. The renovation crew didn't have a bunch of, like, mysterious and terrible accidents or anything. Anything that we normally see when we have a haunted house, nothing happened. So continuing on with, like, this house is very obviously not haunted. The murder that happened in it, however, was terrible. So some reasonings that I thought of, like, why he became like this. Obviously, his mental illness is like the topmost one. Obviously, hallucinogens, hallucinations, anything like that could be as well. Or he could simply just be a crazy dude. Like, I don't mean crazy in terms of mental illness. I mean just, like, crazy in terms of serial killers who have no remorse. Crazy. So, yeah, it just seems like a really creepy house from a murder. Nothing paranormal.
Yeah, I'm going to go out and say that there's nothing probably paranormal in the Perelson house, too. Also, because if they were able to renovate the whole house and demonic entities are pretty possessive over their houses and nothing happened to Lisa Bloom and her husband, then I'm assuming that there's nothing that's really crazy, which is interesting as to why it inspired this season, because for, you know, every Murder House was a pretty good exam, pretty good look at what AHS as a TV show is about. It was very jarring. It was very interesting. But nothing really stuck out to me with the Perelson house. It's like, oh, this is why they did it. But that's just one house. There's another house that I'd like to talk about that I think we will see more about it, and it is the Franklin house. This is also located in the neighborhood of Los Feliz. And so maybe Los Feliz itself is like a portal of negative energy, okay? Because, come on. But this house was specifically on Franklin Avenue. And so, like I said, we're going to refer to it as the Franklin house. In the late 1910s, architect Lloyd Wright arrived in Los Angeles at the request of his father, Frank Lloyd Wright. So Lloyd Wright, the younger one, over the next years worked with Hollywood hotshots and created some really iconic works like the Los Feliz Hollyhock House. Retired artist John Swoden and his wife Ruth hired this young man who was eager to leave his father's shadow to design them a place where they could throw their parties. Lloyd made a Mayan revival-style fortress with a stage, secret room, courtyard, and more. In 1945, Dr. George Hodel bought the iconic house. It was confusing since he wasn't a celebrity, which was the usual kind of clientele in the Los Feliz area, but the more you learned about him, the more it made sense. Dr. Hodel was brilliant, and I mean this by a scientific, career-related way, and he treated some of the biggest, you know, and brightest stars of Hollywood at the time. Hodel lived in the house with his ex-wife Dorothy and his children. But there is a reason that this house inspired the Murder House once, one that you will get as we further go on with it, and true crime fans might have already recognized the name George Hodel because of his relations with the infamous Black Dahlia case. But we're going to get to that in a second. George Hodel was a terrible human being. He would beat his son in the basement, throw drug-heavy parties, and have orgies in his bedroom all the time in a drug-infused cloud. In 1949, Hodel's teenage daughter Tamara ran away, telling the police that she did that because, quote, her home life was too depressing, end quote, and that all of the sex parties at her house were worse than people thought. She accused her father and other adults at these parties of raping her, a crime which Hodel was acquitted from. Horrible. Police found pornography and, quote, questionable objects, end quote, at the Franklin house as well. Hodel later sold the house and left the country. He died in 1999. His son, Steve, a retired Los Angeles Police Department detective, was going through some of his father's things after his passing when he found two pictures of Elizabeth Short, also known as the Black Dahlia. Short's unsolved murder of 1947 continues to be one of the most famous and puzzling unsolved cases of all time. Steve became convinced that it was his father that killed Short and also claimed that Hodel was responsible for many unsolved murders that went on in LA during the time they lived there. He also believed that all of these murders happened in the basement of the Franklin house. Zach Bagans, an occurring name on our podcast, did an episode of Ghost Adventures in the Franklin house, proving that he is a part of the common theory that the house is haunted. It certainly has enough negative energy and continues to be surrounded by the looming darkness of its past, and I believe that it is certainly possible that it could be haunted.
All right, my turn. So for the Franklin house again, there's not really much evidence saying it was haunted at all. Because, like, yes, so many terrible things happened there. Yes, so many terrible murders and things. Hodel sucked so bad. Haven't really seen anything so far. I know none of the next owners have lived in it, but even, like, owning it, like you said before, ghosts and ownership. Nah, we haven't really seen anything paranormal or anything. So instead, I'm going to talk about some more evidence and things that I found while doing my research. There's actually a lot of evidence supporting that Hodel could be the murderer of Short, the Black Dahlia, such as in 2013, a cadaver dog uncovered the faint smell of human remains at four points in Soden House's basement, the exact location that Steve alleged his father had murdered her. Among Steve's books, there was a discovery receipt showing his father purchased cement bags of the type they found at the Dahlia crime scene, and that both Hodel's wife and children were away from the house at the time of the killing.
It's like certainly crazy. I didn't know about, like, I am a true crime lover, so I knew about like the whole Black Dahlia case and all that stuff, but it like took me a while to put like two and two together that like, oh, it was like this guy. And it's like, he's insane. How insane of a person is this guy? Like, in our last episode when we had our meter of how we ranked people, this guy is so far off the scale. Like, why do you suck?
Please, why do you exist?
Why do you exist? But tying back to the Supernatural thing, before I just go on a whole rant about how the human race continues to disappoint me, I, you know, Zach Bacon. We're going to ignore the Zach Bacon part. Zach, though, we love you. Please let us come to your museum in Las Vegas. Prove us wrong, Zach. Prove us wrong. Anyway, I think if there was like a really good proper ghost investigation in the house, I think you would find something, because it's so much negative energy in one place, so much. And also, it's like it has everything that hits my theory list, you know. It's got the history, it's got the tragic past, it has unrest, you know, like this house never got its justice. The house didn't want to be the home of this horrible human being, but it was. I think it could be haunted. I'm gonna leave it.
But we haven't seen anything. Like, obviously, there's a lot of investigators, cops, and whatever who came in with when Steve said that his dad was the Black Dahlia murder, and nothing happened to them.
Not every person is gonna leave a report. So let's say these policemen came in. Policemen meaning women and non-binary people, just as a term, guys. Let's say these police people came in. That was better. And they're walking around, they hear just like knocking or they smell something weird. They're not gonna leave and go straight to the LA Times and be like, there was knocking, it smelled weird. They're not gonna do that, because that's not why they were there, but they still might have noticed it. I'm just saying, not every person leaves a little report case after, because
okay, well, they don't need a report case.
I am still speaking. These police people did not go in looking for the paranormal. So they ignored all of these things that could have been signs of the paranormal. Now you may speak.
Okay. Well, I didn't say they needed to leave a little report, but we have not heard anything about a singular person saying
that is true.
Hey, this is haunted. Like, many, like, there's so many people who have gone inside that house, who have owned that house, maybe not stayed in it, but at least gone in it, and nothing has happened to any of them. Plus, just because they wanted it, like, the whole argument of them going and looking for it. We've had episodes in the past where some people have not gotten looking for trouble and still received it.
This is like the weirdest episode, because that sounded like you were on my side, and like 20 minutes before it sounded like I was on your side. So maybe this is like this is when Arvin and I switch roles. We've talked about so many theories for so long that now I'm a skeptic and he believes in the paranormal.
Y'all, I think there's a demon behind me.
it's an alternate universe. Moving away from the Franklin House, though, I told you guys in the beginning that we were going to revisit the fan favorite Conjuring House, which continues to be one of our most listened to episodes of all time, despite it being our first episode and arguably our worst one. The Conjuring House is definitely a fun episode that you guys should go and check out. Conjuring House, we have an episode, and here's a super quick summary of the Conjuring House before I talk about this new theory that I came upon. So, the Perrin family moved into this farmhouse in Rhode Island in the 1970s. So, the Perrin family moved into a farmhouse in Rhode Island in the 1970s. The Perrins immediately started experiencing strange phenomena, like weird smells, knocking noises, and the movement and knocking over of objects. The house they had bought had allegedly had a long history of murder and devastation, but the primary haunting was done by an entity named Bathsheba Sherman, a woman who had lived in the house and practiced witchcraft throughout her life in the mid-1800s. Ed and Lorraine Warren, two of the most famous paranormal investigators of all time, investigated the house and confirmed that it was indeed haunted. However, nothing really came out of this realization, as the house remains one of the most haunted houses of all time to this day. That was our brief summary. So, I've come across a theory that the Conjuring House is actually a portal for the supernatural, one which will remain inactive until someone moves in. That's kind of iconic. Like, I'm just saying, that's kind of cool. Like, if this house is a portal, first of all, I don't know a lot about portals. If somebody would like to come educate me on it, I would love to hear it. So I'm wondering, is it like common portal etiquette that it remains kind of like not super active haunting wise until somebody moves in, and then like the demons are like, ha, our time to shine, and then it's like, and then they start to, I love the idea though. It has a negative energy to fulfill this. It has a long history of tragedy. It has a very vulnerable family because the parents did not have a lot of money when they moved in, which is why they actually stayed in the house for a really long time, even though all of these terrible hauntings were happening, because they just didn't have the money to go anywhere else. So it has the vulnerable people that these negative entities can prey on. And so I will forever say that the Conjuring House is haunted, and I'm waiting for the day that Arvin and I get to go and explore this. But yes, now Arvin can revisit the Conjuring House too. Go ahead, okay. Arvin.
For the portal theory, I'm literally just going to say one thing, Yeshri. Norma Sutcliffe, the current owner of the Conjuring House, has said that she has not experienced any paranormal activity in her house. If there really was a portal that shows up when someone lives there, she would have experienced something. Moving on. And now, with all the descriptions of why people see some houses as haunted, I think we can better explain the Conjuring House as a lie that's spread into belief because of the way the human mind works. Obviously, the parents and Warrens got an insane amount of money and fame for their story, and were pretty poor before it, or at least the parents were. But the experiences that some people report seeing can all be explained by the minds, sounds, or electronics. So, overall, my take on the Conjuring House remains the same as before, with the only new potential theory, though pretty unlikely, being a hallucinogen present at or around the house, similar to what we saw in our Conjuring 2 episode, which you guys should go listen to if you haven't already, or as a quick refresher of the arguments I made there.
So, Norma Sutcliffe actually is not the current owner of the Conjuring House. When we first recorded this episode, she wasn't it either, but it was still on the market, I believe, and it was still going through. The current owners of the Conjuring House are a couple named Corey and Jennifer Heinzen. I hope I'm not butchering their last name. And so they currently own the Conjuring House, and they actually have said that they have experienced things that, quote, doors opening, footsteps and knocks, end quote, was something that Corey Heinzen said, and they made reports. I'm about to say something, and this is what's going to make Arvin come and unleash his sciencey wrath on me. The Heinzens actually will send out, not invitations, I guess, but they will open their doors to big ghost hunting duos like Ryan and Shane and or other people on YouTube to come and investigate their house. And they've shown in these videos that they do partly believe in this. They do actually, not partly, they do believe in the paranormal. And they do paranormal less, more so they believe that their house is definitively haunted. And I'm always wary to say that owners invite investigators in with Arvin, because if there's one thing Arvin loves, and it's the possibility of people getting something for money. Lack of faith in humanity, Arvin.
We've already established our lack of faith in humanity. It's too late to
backtrack. You've established yours. I'm trying to be better, man. I'm trying to give humans the benefit of the doubt.
Anyways, with this whole thing.
Yes.
So why did it skip the Sutcliffe's?
What do you mean?
Did the demons just decide, like, hey, these guys, they're kind of chill. Let's just not haunt them.
Yeah,
let's
they're like, the next they were like, they like, for the first week they moved in, they were like knocking around, opening doors, and they said nothing. They were like, man, tough crowd. Sheesh. Not worth my time. Who knows? You know, who knows how demonic entities work? Maybe demonologists, actually. If you are a demonologist, listen to this. Please come. We would like to interview you. But why did it skip the Sutcliffe's? I don't have an answer for you, man. Maybe they did experience something, but they were so firm in their skeptic beliefs that they didn't want to admit that it was real, or maybe they just didn't experience anything. But what I know is the parents experienced something, the Hines experienced something. I believe there was somebody midway through who did, doctor or something. Somebody else also did. The Conjuring House, though, is, I see how it, you know, inspired the Murder House season. We have a lot of murders happening in this house. And we have the presence of quite a lot of ghosts, even though Bathsheba is our main woman over here. And, you know, our Murder House season had quite a cast of characters in it. So, yes, we, Arvin and I, though, love an excuse to bring up the Conjuring House as well. And it is, it is one of the, I think, one of the coolest places in the world of all time.
Yeah, for sure. And
that
the
place
last,
is like, yes.
The last argument that I will make for this, just to end it off, Norma Sutcliffe is a paranormal believer. Her husband is not.
Oh, wow. She has betrayed her community. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Norma, we love you.
Yeah, if you're watching this, then watch on.
If you're watching,
listening.
If you're listening, wow, that would have been creepy. If you're listening, please reach out to us. But yes, we're interesting. That is actually quite interesting. The Conjuring House is like my Universal Studios. That's what it is. Okay, two quick things about things that inspired Murder House. One of the houses that inspired Murder House was the Amityville Horror House, which we do also have an episode on. So go and check that out. We're not going to talk Amityville that much because we kind of said all that we had to in that episode. But it is one of the most famous haunted houses in America of all time. The more we continue this podcast, the more I realize how America just has like an unbelievably large fascination with haunted houses. like my God. But I like to talk about a very important house. And this is the actual house that was used in Murder House in the season. And this house is said to be haunted itself.
But before we learn more about the Rosenheim Mansion, let's hear a quick message from our sponsors.
It's called the Rosenheim Mansion. It was named after the man who built it, Alfred Rosenheim. He built the mansion in 1902, and the area around it was known as Billionaire Row, since all of the people in the area were big-shot celebrities and some of the wealthiest people in the state. Dr. Ernst von Schwartz and Angela Oakenfield currently own the house, and they have quite a few things to say about it. First of all, we are seeing the same thing we saw with the Conjuring House, meaning that people have absolutely no self-respect and are trespassing all the time to see the famous AHS house. Oakenfield and her husband are not big supernatural believers, but they do believe that there is something in their home. Oakenfield claims that she saw a butler carrying a tray up and down the stairs while giving a tour a couple of years ago, and when the daughter of a previous owner came to visit the house, the daughter confirmed that she also used to see the spirit of a butler. In the 90s, the Rosenheim Mansion was actually home to a nun convent, and Oakenfield was able to get in touch with one of the volunteers for the nuns in that time. The volunteers at the said that the nuns had brought in a rocking chair into the home, and later, a nun saw an apparition of a past sister sitting on it. Guests in the house have claimed that they felt uneasy while being in the basement, and some have even claimed that something touched them when they were down there. No paranormal investigator, though, has ever been invited into the house.
Okay, I like to see the fact that no paranormal investigator has ever been invited to the house. This helps me rule out money and her fame.
This could mean that Oakenfield and, you know, her and Dr. Schwartz might not believe that in paranormal investigators either, you know, like they might think that they are going to exploit the house or use it for money or whatever, especially if they're already seeing so many people kind of berate their privacy because of this house.
No, yeah, definitely. With the whole, like, the reasons behind why this house is haunted. Again, like I've said, like all of the theories before, if they're not letting any investigators in the house, that means there's probably also not a scientist checking for things like electromagnetic pulses, any hallucinogens, any of the above reasons, or frequency, hertz.
Not entering paranormal investigators means you are ruling out both science and the supernatural. So, what are your options here? I gotta say, though, a ghost butler, that I said it once before, I'll say it again, that's kind of iconic. That has got to be the greatest ghost you could have. Or, like, a laundry ghost. Like, you do your laundry, like, you just put it in the washer, and then you come home, and all of a sudden it's, like, all folded in a basket, right? That's the kind of ghost, that's pretty great. Because could this butler ghost, like, butler to you? Unless it's, like, a demon that's pretending to be a butler, and then it's actually going to, like, possess you. That would suck. But
I think if it was a poltergeist, it'd be the easiest because they could just make like the clothes float and fold themselves and do everything.
That is true because poltergeists just like to be annoying. They just like to like they just like to do things. But if it was like a helpful poltergeist, then who knows? I thought the butler thing was like very interesting, and the nun convent thing I thought was quite interesting, with the apparition on it. Apparitions are always interesting. I would love to see an apparition one day. I know if I did and I'd call Arvin, I was like, Arvin, I just saw an apparition. Arvin would be like, are you high? And it would be quite a conversation.
Well, I'd first ask if you were high, and if the answer to that was no, which it should be, then heard the electromagnetic frequency. I don't know how to check
those Arvin things. Arvin would take me to a database the next day that would like check if any I've been around any radiation or like any of that.
No, that could be my senior research project.
In conclusion, I think houses are fully capable of being haunted if they've had a lot of history of negative energy and bad things happening, and I think houses can be haunted.
And I think that is fully and truly impossible because nothing can haunt anything because the paranormal is false.
Well, there you have it, folks. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we would love for you to leave us a message on our anchor.fm website with anything you would like us to know. You can also reach out to us on one of our social media accounts at Behind the Story with a period between the I and N for Instagram and an underscore between the I and N for Twitter.
In the bio of our social medias, you will find our website where you can submit your very own paranormal experiences story with us or anything else you'd like us to know.
Now, before we sign off, two things. One, once again, happy, happy Valentine's Day. We hope you and your significant other greatly enjoyed this episode. We hope we were able to spark an intense argument between the both of you about whether you believed in the paranormal or not. And we greatly hope that we did not cause a breakup. We're hoping for that. And the second thing is that we are going to release our very last AHS episode on April 1st. So you don't want to miss that. Make sure you tune in then.
And with that reminder, we hope you have a great week. We hope your house isn't haunted. And we hope that you always remember
that there's always more to uncover behind the story.